Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
President Trump's sons are reportedly planning campaign appearances for the day of the Iowa caucuses. Don Jr. will be knocking on doors, while Eric will be coming out from under children's beds.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth talks to filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan. Plus, M. Night takes a few more questions backstage at Studio AG just for this podcast. But first, a closer look.
The new poll says the majority of Americans disapprove of President Trump's handling of Iran and his own team struggles to defend his lies and borrows directly from George W. Bush's playbook. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. You might remember that throughout President Obama's two terms, Republicans, including Donald Trump, objected to virtually everything he did on the grounds that he was trampling on the Constitution they supposedly cherished.
I feel very strongly about our Constitution. I'm proud of it. I love it. And I want to go through the Constitution. That's what we want to do. I mean, we want to bring the Constitution back.
I will give President Obama and the Senate Democrats credit. They believe in principles of big government. They believe in this relentless assault on our constitutional rights.
This president wants to act as if he's a king, as if he's a dictator.
You see, I think we need to return to constitutional government. I think they shredded the Constitution, especially during the health care debate.
Is it time the president just already do this already, torch the Constitution?
No! Not the pocket Constitution!
Melodrama doesn't work as well when you're threatening a reproduction. It's like saying, I'm so mad, I'm gonna flip over my car.
You left me no choice.
Also, I wish he'd actually done it because then he'd set off the fire sprinklers at Fox News and Rudy Giuliani would have melted like the Wicked Witch of the West. All you'd see is a suit, some shoes, and his big old Yankee ring. So, the right spent 8 years constantly lecturing the rest of us about the sanctity of the Constitution and obsessively whining that Obama was supposedly shredding it. And then earlier this month, Trump ordered a strike that killed a top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, without congressional approval. The Constitution clearly and unequivocally gives Congress and only Congress the power to declare war. And yet last week, after the House passed a resolution reining in Trump's war powers, he complained at a rally that it would be inconvenient for him to notify Congress before moving forward with an act of war.
These are split-second decisions. You have to make a decision. So they don't want me to make that decision. They want me to call up. Maybe go over there. Let me go over to Congress. Or come on over to the White House. Let's talk about it. When can you make it? Well, I won't be able to make it today, sir. How about, let's say, in a couple of days? Oh, sure. Come on over. We had to make a decision. We didn't have time to call up Nancy, who is not operating with a full deck.
She's not operating with a full deck. You're operating with a pair of deuces in that car that has the rules on it. So, Trump Trump circumvented Congress to launch a strike on an official of a foreign government, a decision that has been deeply unpopular with the American people. According to a new poll out this week, a majority of Americans disapprove of Trump's handling of Iran and say they feel less safe as a result. So to try to justify the attack, Trump's team has claimed that Soleimani posed an imminent threat and that they had to stop it, although Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been incredibly cagey about that.
President Trump says that General Soleimani was planning a, quote, imminent attack. What was the plan? Who were the targets? And how soon?
There's things we simply cannot make public about what it is we knew at that time and what, in fact, we know today about the continuing activity.
So was the justification in that he's been this destabilizing force in the region for so long, or was the justification this imminent threat?
Chuck, it's never one thing.
There is no doubt that there were a series of imminent attacks that were being plotted by Qasem Soleimani. We don't know precisely when, and we don't know precisely where, but it was real.
When you say the attacks were imminent, how imminent were they? Were we talking about days? Were we talking about weeks?
If you're an American in the region, days and weeks, this is not something that's relevant.
These guys claim there's an imminent attack, and then when you ask them for specifics, suddenly they turn into characters in a French film.
Days, weeks, what is the difference? Weeks are days, days are weeks. What matters is love, no? Je suis Pompeo.
C'est vrai? Then the Trump administration... No, then... Then the Trump administration sent military briefers to Congress to try to convince them that the threat was real, but that only made things worse with members of both parties coming away from the briefing furious and unsatisfied.
I had hoped and expected to receive more information outlining the legal, factual, and moral justification for the attack. I was left somewhat unsatisfied.
There was no specific information given to us of a specific attack, and none of it was overwhelming that X was going to happen.
My reaction to this briefing was it was sophomoric and utterly unconvincing. I was, well, utterly unpersuaded about any evidence about the imminence of a threat that was new or compelling.
We did not get information inside that briefing that there was a specific imminent threat. I think it is likely because it doesn't exist.
Of course it doesn't exist. If Donald Trump says, trust me, the thing exists, it definitely does not exist. He's like a magician who says he's going to pull a rabbit out of his hat, looks down, realizes the rabbit chewed through the hat and escaped, and says, trust me, the rabbit's there. So because no one believed him, Trump decided to do his usual routine of making even more outlandish lies, changing his story multiple times within the span of just a few days.
We did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy.
Mr. President.
Blow up the embassy in Baghdad. Can you provide more details on what that plot was?
No, I think it was obvious. And he had more than that particular embassy in mind.
He was looking very seriously at our embassies and not just the embassy in Baghdad.
Don't the American people have a right to know what specifically was targeted without revealing methods and sources?
Well, I don't think so, but we will tell you that probably it was going to be the embassy in Baghdad.
Did he have large-scale attacks planned for other embassies? And if those were planned, why can't we reveal that to the American people? Wouldn't that help your case?
I can reveal that I believe it would have been four embassies.
In the span of 2 days, he went from not talking about embassies at all to saying it was one embassy, to saying it was multiple embassies, to saying it was four embassies. I know Trump is a bad liar, but even for him, it's obvious he's making stuff up off the top of his head. What if it was four embassies? Is that a number where you would all leave me alone? What if they were embassy suites? I mean, that would be bad, right? That would be a bad thing. In fact, Trump's lies have spun so far out of control that even his own defense secretary, Mark Esper, had a hard time defending them this weekend when he made the rounds on the Sunday shows.
Many members of Congress from both parties have said that none of the briefings mentioned threats to four U.S. embassies. Why is President Trump telling this to Fox News, but the administration is not briefing Congress on this threat of four embassies, unless there was actually no specific intelligence that there was a threat to four embassies.
The president never said there was specific intelligence. Yes. What the president said was he believed that it probably and could have been attacks against additional embassies. The president didn't say there was a tangible, he didn't cite a specific piece of evidence. What he said is he believed.
Are you saying there wasn't one?
I didn't see one with regard to four embassies.
You're the Secretary of Defense. If it's real, why wouldn't you have seen it? You think Donald Trump has his own top secret intelligence he's not sharing with anyone until he blurts it out on Fox News? You think he's out there parachuting into the Iraqi desert with night vision goggles, collecting intel on his own? Bad news, guys. Everything's green. Now, if you're getting a feeling of deja vu at this point, it's because we've been through this before. In the run-up to the Iraq War in 2002 and 2003, the Bush administration repeatedly lied about the intelligence they used to justify that war in eerily similar ways. They claimed definitively that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he had ties to the terrorists who carried out 9/11. They manipulated intelligence and concocted all kinds of lies about that intelligence to justify an immoral and catastrophic war that destabilized the region and the world. And they were adamant and unequivocal about it. Of course, in George W. Bush's case, he couldn't always keep his talking points straight.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
No terrorist state poses a greater or more immediate threat to the security of our people and the stability of the world than the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
There's a lot of talk about Iraq on our TV screens, and there should be, because we're trying to figure out how best to make the world a peaceful place. There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
That's how they say it in Texas? There's an old saying in Texas, give a man a fish and now that man has a fish. And he can eat that fish. Or he can keep it as a pet. What I'm saying is, Saddam Hussein is stockpiling weapons of mass destruction. Remember when we thought we could never elect a dumber president than George W. Bush? And then yesterday, our current president tweeted about impeachment and said, hose Republicans. Voted 195-0 against it. Well, I mean, I guess we can't expect the real estate developer to be able to spell the word house. Also, he lives in the most famous house in the world. And because none of his aides will ever tell him he's wrong, they're gonna have to change all the signs now. And then at his rally last week, Trump could barely get through the standard end of his stump speech without sounding like he just downed a bottle of Novocaine.
We will make America wealthy again. We will make America strong again.
Did he just do a keg stand? If your friend started talking like that, you'd rush him to the hospital to have their stomach bumped. He sounds like he just got knocked out in the first round by Ronda Rousey. Donald, don't get up. I can do it. I'm feeling strong again. And I think even Trump knows on some level that he can't paper over his lies with charm because he doesn't have any. In fact, he seemed to admit as much in this brief flash of self-awareness at his rally last week.
The radical Democrats have never been more extreme than they are right now. They are stone cold crazy. You know, it's interesting. As I'm saying this stuff, you know, they want crime, they want chaos. I'm saying all this stuff, and then I say, gee, now I sort of understand why they hate me, right?
Wow, it's like he just had a breakthrough in therapy. He should have had a psychiatrist on stage next to him saying, expand on that. Anyway, the point is, the Bush administration manipulated the intelligence lie and insisted that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and ties to the terrorists who carried out 9/11. It's just as we've seen with Trump, Pompeo, and Esper. Even when Bush officials admitted there was uncertainty and disagreement about the intelligence, they used ominous language to cow people who dared to question them into backing down.
You will get different estimates about precisely how close he is. We do know that he is actively pursuing a nuclear weapon.
There will always be some uncertainty
about how quickly he can acquire a nuclear weapon. But we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Remember that line? So many of the most powerful people in our most powerful institutions went along with that line, though it was obviously insane. It's like if your husband said, I think I have a UTI, and you were like, no, you don't. And he was like, okay, well, I guess we'll find out when my penis falls off. Of course, it turns out there was neither a mushroom cloud nor a smoking gun, or as Trump has repeatedly called it, a smocking gun. That's probably why Trump's speechwriters have never even bothered to write a line like that for him, because they know he'd never be able to pronounce the words. We don't want the smocking gun to be a mushroom pizza. That is something that cannot be
tolerated.
We've been through this before. A lawless administration lying to justify a potentially disastrous and illegal act of war. Trump pulled back from the brink last week, but it's very possible he could do this all over again, which means Congress must use its power to stop him. Because, as they say in Texas,
you can't get fooled again.
This has been A Closer Look.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Our guest is an Oscar-nominated writer and director behind films like The Sixth Sense, Signs, and The Village. He is an executive producer of the series Servant, which is streaming on Apple TV+. Please welcome back to the show, M. Night Shyamalan, everyone. You?
I'm good. I was backstage and Tiffany twerked for me. It was,
yeah.
I mean, it's good.
Well, wait, you were backstage probably looking for Migos on your phone, being like, I have to have this ready
no,
for what I
say. She did it without music.
She's a very kind person.
Yeah. She's just
You're obviously, you're known for being a film director. It's very exciting to have you producing a television series, directing some episodes. This is, as one might expect from you, a fairly haunting idea about a couple. I don't know why I'm laughing. It's a couple who suffered a tragic loss. Yeah. There's a nanny. Explain the concept real quick and how it came about.
You know, I get offered certain things to either, you know, write, rewrite, or direct, or produce. And this particular idea came to me of a couple that had lost a child, and they do this very fringe therapy, this very rare therapy. It's actually a real therapy where they take a doll and pretend that their child is still alive and to help with the emotions and all. And it was such a tragic kind of setup, and it's very eerie in and of itself. And this doll that they're using, the mom thinks the child's alive, and she believes it so much that she hires a nanny. And then the nanny comes in, and the nanny immediately starts treating the doll like it's alive. And so it's a very eerie setup. And so I was like, I need to know what happens to this couple.
Yes, yeah. And that's how you get into it. Yes. And I want to show a clip real quick, because this is sort of, explain the clip before we show it. Like,
yeah, it's true. I can barely show you guys anything about this show without giving too much away, but this is in episode 9, which I directed, and weird things are afoot, and strange things are happening, and this is a moment, I believe, where she wakes up in the middle of the day, and the car alarm is going off, and it just won't stop, and she's trying to find the key, and she finds the key, and it just won't stop, and there's something that's going on that's infecting their lives in this house.
All right, let's take a look real quick. See, it's very haunting. You make very haunting things. It's very distressing to watch what you make.
It's a mystery, and it's been fun to do it in this long form like this with Apple. It's been fun.
Do you ever get scared when you're watching something that you have done?
I'm definitely if you watched a movie with me, if we were in a movie theater together, I am the best audience member. I'm squirming and I'm jumping and I'm like, oh my gosh. That happened to Kevin Hart? Oh, my God. I'm definitely the guy that's totally reacting to everything. And even in my stuff, when it's working, I start to react like that as well.
And so, obviously, when you make a film, you do test screenings, you are watching audience members. Are you looking for something from an audience member when they're watching something you've made?
Well, it's really, really interesting because I make thrillers generally, like suspense thrillers. And what ends up happening, and I noticed this when I was younger, and I didn't realize this was actually a real thing, but as I've made more movies, it's actually a science, what I'm telling you. So you screen the first cut of the movie, and it's really long, and it has, like, everything in it, and it's not paced correctly. And about 50 people will go to the bathroom during the screening of the movie. They'll just get up and go at some point in the movie. And as you make the movie and you keep on doing it, then 30 people go to the bathroom. And then the time next time is 20 people, and then 10 people, then 4 people. And then the last cut of the movie, when it's, like, ready to go out, it's 2 people, and they're running, and they're backwards watching the screen as they're going to the bathroom. And what's really interesting is that, like, you stop thinking about yourself when you're completely connected to the movie. And, like, the 500 people forget they needed to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the perfect movie would just be everybody goes in their pants.
Yeah, I've never achieved that.
I've never
achieved that depends level of it. Success.
I do, as would be expected, like, you know, you mentioned that it's like a baby doll.
Yeah.
The baby doll, though, is, we have a photo of it. It is a little bit, I think, more lifelike than people may have been expected. And that's a real, yeah, exactly. And on set, I would imagine it's fairly, as far as props go, it's probably fairly creepy.
That is the doll that they use in the therapy. We had one made for us, and it's literally moves and it sits with you like a real doll. My mother-in-law, who lives in India, came to visit me, and I was showing her my offices. And me being a really bad son-in-law, I decided to trick her. And so we were walking through the offices, and I went, Oh my God, someone left a baby.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. And she was like, you know, she's an older Indian woman. And I was like, oh, my God. And I was like, and she went, oh, no, oh, my God. Oh. And then I was like, who would do this? Who would do this? And she was like, what is this? And I handed it to her, and she starts cradling it because it weighs and it moves just like a baby. And she starts tearing up, and I'm like, this has gone too far.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just kidding.
Do you not get this enough from your work?
I'm just kidding. It's not real. And she keeps on doing this as she's like, it's a doll and you can't stop. Your body won't stop because it feels
oh
and looks
God.
Like a real doll. I'm sorry I did that to her.
Yes. I don't know if you had to apologize to your parents when you decided to be a director, but I know they sort of famously wanted you to be a doctor.
That's right.
And when you went to them, and you had been directing from at a very young age, this was something that was clearly your passion. Did they accept it early on, or did you have to fight through it?
No, it's, you know, I'm Indian. I don't know if you guys know that. And they don't, Indian parents don't really, like, yell like that. They just kind of get disappointed.
Yeah.
My dad was watching hockey. He was a big hockey fan.
Yeah.
And I was like, Dad, I'm going to Tisch Film School. I just got in. I got a scholarship. And he was watching, and he's just silent, watching the Flyers. And I was like, I walked out. It was like a sad moment. It was a sad moment. He just thought, he came to America, they followed the dream, came to Philadelphia, and I just threw it all away to become like a goth rock star or something.
But now you have children. We were talking backstage, 3 children, and they want to be in the arts as well.
Right.
Musicians, yeah. a film director as well.
Yeah.
Is that exciting for you?
It is. We're really serious about the arts in our house. I'm dead serious about it. So I'm like, you know, hey, if you're going to do it to make it and become famous, forget it. Not in this house. And, and so I was like, you have to come at it with sacredness. And so, like, our oldest is a musician. Her first album will come out this year, but she's trained since 4 years old, a classical pianist, blah, 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 and has done, put that amount of work in. And then my middle daughter is a director, actually, and has been writing and directing for forever, and they take it dead serious.
And now if they had come to you and said, I'm actually going to go to medical school, would you have just silently been disappointed?
Probably. I'd just be watching the Sixers.
And I think it's easy to forget because, you know, films are around for a long time, we get comfortable with them, but you were Sixth Sense, you were in your 20s when you directed that. And yet, you had directed a lot of things leading up to that, things we hadn't seen.
Yeah, failures.
Failures.
That's what you're trying to say, yes.
I was going to let you say it, but yeah. I think there's value to that, right? Like, I mean, you don't make a success without a bunch of failures. And that must have been something, especially with your kids being in the arts as well, you tried to teach them, which is like, hey, you don't hit the jackpot the first time out.
No. When I'm on them the most, I'm really telling them you're not failing enough. That's the thing I say the most in the house. You're not failing enough. You're protecting yourself. That gets you nowhere. failure is not a pejorative thing. It's where you get this exponential growth. So you iterate. My whole thing is about iterating as a person, as an artist. Be in situations that you can safely iterate as fast as you can.
Well, it certainly paid off for you. I will have to expect that it will happen for your children as well. Thanks so much for making time. It's always so great to see you.
Thank you.
M. Night Shyamalan, everybody, serving and streaming on Apple TV+.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with M. Night Shyamalan. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you this question, myself included. I think a lot of us right now are saying what we're living through feels like a horror movie. Do you feel that way? And does that make your job as a filmmaker of so many thrillers more difficult?
You know, I think times, the cultural context really affects how you tell stories to a mass audience. If you're trying to reach across age barriers and cultural barriers, where we are is a big factor in that. And kind of you can see how we approach a story in the 1990s to now is very, very different. Because if you think of like the movies in the 90s, they could have been more straightforward, more earnest, more feel good, and have these positive kind of entry points, and you can go from that narrative. But now you really need to acknowledge that these are difficult times, and there's a cynicism there. And you can still get to positivity, you can still get to light, but you need to acknowledge that angle with the narration, with the characters. And so, you know, Joker will resonate more today than it would in the 90s. That would seem nihilistic.
And then when you're creating maybe a new script, do you start with the context we're in, or does it start with characters? What does the beginning of the process look like?
You know, that varies. You know, I'm writing a new one now, and I guess the themes of the movie are really on my mind. I guess that's true for all of them. Where am I as a human being? And then I'm kind of telling a kind of a diary version of that through the movie. So Unbreakable, I was feeling kind of gray and kind of burdened, and I wasn't sure, you know, am I this guy that people think? I'm
that
not sure.
That tracks with the film.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is right? A fantastic film.
So thank you so much. And so each movie has that feeling. And then during the years that I had kids, I did a lot of family movies, and it's very, you know, you start thinking about the things that are important to you. And now the kids are grown up, I tell darker stories, and it sounds kind of silly to kind of, but it actually, because I write everything, it feels very organic, because those are the things I'm thinking about. But it could be anything. It could be a scene or a line or a character. But oftentimes it's a kind of a setup, like a family wakes up and there's a crop circle in their backyard. And, oh, wow, what if we told an invasion of the world story from one family's perspective?
Right. And that's, you know, I've heard you say before, that specifically, that storyline was tied to you still living and working in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But does that make it challenging to live in Pennsylvania in terms of, I imagine, a very frequent commute to places like Los Angeles?
I think what you were first referencing is that the stories that I come up with are more connected to things I see, like crops in the fields,
right,
or like the village. There are these old estates around, and hey, what's behind that fence? And you start thinking like that. I don't actually go to Los Angeles all that much. It's still magical to me. So I go there, I go, oh, I'm going to Hollywood. This is so cool.
And one of the most acclaimed directors currently working is amazed to be in Hollywood. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I still have that kid feeling, because you could probably, all the days that I've ever spent in Hollywood, you put them all together, it's probably 60, 70 days.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, in my whole life. So it's still special. It still feels like it represents the dreaming part of when you were a kid.
That's nice to hear that someone of your stature still feels kind of the magic of filmmaking. That's so exciting to hear, I think.
It really feels like that. I mean, look, it's now it's slightly different. When I come, everyone says yes to a meeting. So like when I come, and so I get to meet everybody that I want to meet, and it's fun. Oh, you want to meet for drinks? You want to have dinner? And and so that even adds to the fun of it. And I think on their end, I'm one of the rare people that doesn't live there. So they treat it more precious than maybe they would another situation.
Totally. So you don't spend a lot of time in LA, but you've made a lot of big Hollywood films, you could say. This is your second television show?
Yes. It's the second time I've done television. This is the first time I've kind of really, really owned it and really control it. And so it's been a very different situation and very exciting. The first season was so rewarding, so fun.
It is a fascinating and creepy and really engaging show. We were talking earlier, and at the end of the first episode, something happens, and you are just like very quickly clicking to the next episode. But I'm wondering if the format of television opens up new opportunities for you, because you have a break after 30 some minutes that you don't have in a 2-hour film.
Well, I'm learning a lot doing it about storytelling. Look, the format of long-form storytelling on television is character-driven. It's primarily,
right.
you tune in to see Tony Soprano in episode 13, not necessarily the plot of episode 13 of The Sopranos. And I love that. I'm a character-driven writer and filmmaker, but in film, it's a two-hour format, so it's very much plot-driven. So there's a, you know, the terrorists are taking over the building, the boat's sinking, whatever it is, and there's you're driven, and you do character work along the way. And so the husband and wife in Die Hard can have a relationship and grow, but it has to be as the terrorists are being taken out.
Right.
And in TV, you can take your time and really do that. So that was really exciting. But the format is kind of, when I'm thinking about it, this show is 30 minutes, episodes. When you're thinking about sequences that have these kind of punches at the end of 30 minutes, it's a very exciting way to tell stories.
Yeah, and it's certainly an exciting way to watch the story. Because you can just assume that you're only a few minutes away from something big happening again, at least with this show.
Oh, you're bringing up something really interesting, which is, and you can just say shut up if we're going off on a tangent.
No, please. So I'm saying something interesting. I'm not going to tell you to stop talking now.
You're so interesting.
Well, as you were saying.
I always wonder why it is we can stop a show and watch a commercial and we're engaged. I didn't ask you to talk about toilet paper. Why am I watching you? And I've always been fascinated by that. And doing this television format, it reminds me of, I read a lot. And I read 50 books a year. And when the book is 800, 900 pages, it takes me much longer than three books that are 350 pages, right? When I know where the end is and I'm moving through it in a narrative that's moving quickly to to conclusion, I get there much faster by page count. I just keep on going. When I know it's 800, 900 pages, I know I'm so far from the end that I'm weighed down. And this format of 30 minutes, just what you said, you know it's coming. There's an answer coming. There's a thing coming. You're driven, and I think it makes it so you're so... It doesn't... Like, when you're watching the 30 minutes, they feel like 15 because of that.
And there's so many things to watch right now. I think it feels more... It feels less daunting to start something where you know there will be breaks, and you know you can digest it maybe easier than, like, The Irishman, which is super long, but incredibly celebrated. But people may put it off so they can watch, you know,
I don't know how many times I'm dying to watch The Irishman.
Me as well.
Me, like, that literally I've been waiting to watch it. And I don't know how many times. Then I have it at home. And I don't know how many times I've said to the family, hey, let's watch The Irishman. Yeah. And then they're like, how long is it?
I know.
And then you're like, oh, we have to set aside the whole night. And then, but what ends up happening is you watch a two-hour movie, then you make tacos and you hang out.
It's the same amount of time. And everyone who's seen The Irishman is like, it's great.
Yes, just everybody says that.
Just stop putting it up, just watch the film.
But I think it's that knowing we're in a long narrative. And so at any given point, you still have so far to go. This is to what you were saying. Why I was saying it was so interesting when you said some combination of words that made me think, wow, you are aware of where you are in the arc of the story at all times.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to keep watching this show. It hooked me very quickly, and then it keeps hooking you further. Congratulations on the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, brother. Yeah, I'm excited for you to see episode 9, which I directed. So you got to catch up.
30 seconds of it so far, so I got to catch up. Yes. 7 back. I'll make it.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.